John Cage is probably the most controversial composer in this country today, at least to the general public. He has been vilified, denounced as a fraud, and praised to the skies. In recent years, his concerts, at least those at which he himself has been present, have played to packed audiences throughout the world. He is that rarity of American composers, and especially of American composers of the so-called avant-garde, the performing composer who supports himself through his music. Like Schoenberg, with whom he studied composition in Los Angeles, Cage's career as a composer is cleanly divided by two radically different aesthetic attitudes. Grappling with so protean a personality and with so challenging an intellect and a creative spirit is difficult, and learning enough in an hour's time about the methods and attitudes which have formed this man to be able to understand his concepts and his achievements is, of course, impossible. Fortunately, there are three documents easily available which are of considerable help in understanding both Cage and his music. There is a long article about Cage in the New Yorker of November 28, 1964, which has a good deal of biographical information, nearly all of which is accurate, but, according to Mr. Cage, arranged in a manner more or less arbitrary by its writer, Calvin Tompkins. There is a catalog of Cage's compositions available from Peter's edition in New York, which is absorbing reading even to non-musicians, for it contains long descriptions of his works and their manner of composition and performance, in addition to an interview with Roger Reynolds. And best of all, there is a book of essays on music by the composer himself, in which his attitudes and opinions are spelled out in the clearest of language, once one becomes accustomed to the typographical layout of the essays. The title of this book, characteristically enough, is Silence. It is published by the Wesleyan University Press and costs $10. The book is beautifully made and bound and should be of profound interest to anyone who is at all interested in current tendencies in the arts in general. Cage's achievements currently tend to a great degree toward a synthesis of arts, not in the restricted sense that this phrase is used when referring, for example, to opera or the film, but in the sense that his investigations are increasingly directed toward the underlying attitudes toward human endeavor which are common to the speculations of diverse artists, whatever their field. And the operative word here is speculations, for the implication of Cage's statement that he is frankly an experimenter is that he is pursuing an investigation. Perhaps we can better understand the nature of this investigation, to which Cage, by his own statement, is dedicating his time, if we review some of the decisive turns of the composer's life and career. He was born in Los Angeles, the son of an inventor, in 1912. He started studying piano in the fourth grade. He disliked the exercises he had to play, and was depressed at the realization that he would never play with the facility displayed by his teachers. But when his aunt taught him sight reading, he felt the whole world of music opening to him. He explored the literature for the piano, but not without a guide. His aunt's disapproval of Bach and Beethoven restricted his investigations to the work of minor 19th century composers, and he thought of dedicating his life to the performance of the piano music of Edvard Grieg. In the meantime, he was getting straight A's in school, and graduated with the highest grades in the history of his high school. At Pomona College, his grades took a sudden dip. In Cage's words, as quoted in the New Yorker profile, "One day, our history assignment was to go to the library and read a certain number of pages in a book. The idea of everybody reading exactly the same information just revolted me. I decided to make an experiment. I went to the library and read things that had nothing to do with the assignment, and approached the exam with that sort of preparation." The young Cage's grades dropped to C's and B's, and he persuaded his parents to send him to Europe rather than another 2 years of school. In Paris, he became interested in modern painting, and at the Paris Conservatoire, he discovered the work of J.S. Bach. He also discovered modern music, or rather was introduced to it by the pianist John Kirkpatrick. After 18 months, Cage returned to the United States in the heart of the Depression. He set himself up as a lecturer on modern music and painting, studying the contents each day of the following day's lecture. He began composing, and ultimately, in 1934, after a year and a half in New York, where he studied with Adolf Weiss, he returned to study in Los Angeles with Arnold Schoenberg. During the course of these studies, a crisis presented itself. Cage's account is included in the New Yorker article. "Several times I tried to explain to Schoenberg that I had no feeling for harmony. He told me that without a feeling for harmony, I would always encounter a wall through which I could not pass. My reply was that in that case I would devote my life to beating my head against that wall, and maybe this is what I've been doing ever since. We'll refer to this confrontation later. Let's proceed now with a resume of Cage's activities in the ensuing years. Shortly after his studies with Schoenberg, Cage was introduced to Oskar Fischinger, an early abstract filmmaker, and about this time he began to be interested in the uses of noise elements in music. The techniques of filmmaking also colored his thoughts on the methodology of composing music, and in 1937 he delivered a talk in Seattle called The Future of Music, Credo. The text is printed in Cage's book, Silence. The lecture is organized into principal and subsidiary paragraphs. The principal sections are as follows. I believe that the use of noise to make music will continue and increase until we reach a music produced through the aid of electrical instruments, which will make available for musical purposes any and all sounds that can be heard. Photoelectric, film, and mechanical mediums for the synthetic production of music will be explored. Whereas, in the past, the point of disagreement has been between dissonance and consonance, it will be, in the immediate future, between noise and so-called musical sounds. The present methods of writing music, principally those which employ harmony and its reference to particular steps in the field of sound, will be inadequate for the composer, who will be faced with the entire field of sound. New methods will be discovered bearing a definite relation to Schoenberg's 12-tone system and present methods of writing percussion music, and any other methods which are free from the concept of a fundamental tone. The principle of form will be our only constant connection with the past. Although the great form of the future will not be as it was in the past, at one time the fugue and at another the sonata, it will be related to these, as they are to each other, through the principle of organization, or man's common ability to think. At this point, then, Cage might have agreed with a statement made by Karlheinz Stockhausen last year. To compose is to make the world become one. This is the aim of all human spiritual endeavor. But at the same time, Cage was thinking enough about the attitude which was later to dominate his work, that of experimentation, to be able, at least tentatively, to codify it. And in 1939, we find him saying, in an article published in Dance Observer, "Percussion music is revolution. Sound and rhythm have too long been submissive to the restrictions of 19th century music. Today we are fighting for their emancipation. Tomorrow, with electronic music in our ears, we will hear freedom. Instead of giving us new sounds, the 19th century composers have given us endless arrangements of the old sounds. We have turned on radios and always known when we were tuned to a symphony. The sound has always been the same, and there has not been even a hint of curiosity as to the possibilities of rhythm. For interesting rhythms, we have listened to jazz. At the present stage of revolution, a healthy lawlessness is warranted. Experiment must necessarily be carried on by hitting anything, tin pans, rice bowls, iron pipes, anything we can lay our hands on. Not only hitting, but rubbing, smashing, making sound in every possible way. In short, we must explore the materials of music. What we can't do ourselves will be done by machines and electrical instruments which we will invent. The conscientious objectors to modern music will, of course, attempt everything in the way of a counter-revolution. Musicians will not admit that we are making music. They will say that we are interested in superficial effects, or, at most, are imitating oriental or primitive music. New and original sounds will be labeled as noise. But our common answer to every criticism must be to continue working and listening, making music with its materials, sound and rhythm, disregarding the cumbersome, top-heavy structure of musical prohibitions. In the 2 years between the two statements that we have read from Silence, Cage had moved with his wife to Seattle, where he worked as an accompanist for dance classes at a progressive school which, as Calvin Tompkins says in his New Yorker profile, stressed the creative arts. While in Seattle, Cage organized an ensemble of percussion instruments, and his composition gradually assumed the direction he was to follow up until the late 50s. Before the move to Seattle, and to a certain extent afterward, his works were organized in a more or less traditional way on a more or less harmonic basis. While studying with Richard Bühlig in Los Angeles, for example, immediately after his return from Europe and his discovery of modern music, Cage, then about 20, composed in a method of his own device which restricted his pitches to 4 octaves, with a complex rule determining when a given pitch might be used again in the music. Later, he produced some work in the 12-tone technique. In Seattle, however, his interest in percussion quite naturally led to an interest in non-pitched sounds, and from there to a preoccupation with rhythms as a structural medium in composition. Thanks to the monumental recording of the Town Hall Concert of 1958, which saw performances of compositions dating over the 25 years from 1933 to 1958, we can illustrate the difference in Cage's music occasioned by this changing interest. Here is one of the 6 short inventions written in 1933, although orchestrated in 1958. It is one of the works which the Peters Edition catalog describes as dealing with the problem of keeping repetitions of individual tones of the 3 superimposed 25-tone ranges as far apart as possible, even though each voice is obliged to express all 25 tones before introducing a repetition of any one of them. In other words, this is a serial composition, although not a 12-tone composition, and since the structure, the way the music is sectioned, depends not upon the traditional harmony, based on the octave and a keynote, but depends rather on the principle of rules regarding the repetition of a given pitch, the effect to a casual listener is much the same as that of a composition in the 12-tone technique. It might be borne in mind that this method of ordering his music was devised by Cage as the solution of a weakness noticed by his teacher, Richard Bielig, who at first criticized his music as formless. Here are 2 of the 6 short inventions of 1933. Cage's compositions in this vein gradually gave way to music based on the expression of his newfound interest in percussive sounds, the structure of which was based, of course, on rhythms. Although he may not yet have defined this kind of musical structure in his own mind, we will see that later on Cage's whole attitude toward the structure of music grows out of this change of focus from pitch organization to rhythmic, or later, durational organization. Here, from 1939, is an excerpt from the first construction in metal. The first construction in metal, an excerpt of which you have just heard, is an early example of those works of John Cage whose formal structure is based on durations. To a certain extent, all music has been based on durational formal elements, for all music takes place in time. Traditionally tonal music, however, the music written between, say, 1750 and 1910, is structured on considerations of tonal rather than temporal elements. That is to say, the formal sections of traditional music are marked by the establishment of a home key and the moving away from it toward an eventual return. In many ways, the music of Franz Schubert is the embodiment of this method at its most formalistic. Whole sections of a composition may be set off, one from another, only by their proceeding on a different tonal level, so to speak. The first construction in metal, on the other hand, is not organized structurally on this basis. Instead, the structural organization is based on durations, more specifically on the proportions of the durations of its subsections. This, of course, was the answer to the problem set by Schoenberg when he challenged Cage to devote his life to writing music although lacking a feeling for harmony. A quotation from Cage, included in the New Yorker article, clarifies this. Schoenberg had always stressed the structural function of harmony as a means of relating the parts to the whole. But traditional harmonic structure has been in a process of disintegration ever since Beethoven, a process that shows up very clearly in the music of Wagner and of Schoenberg himself. I realized, moreover, that harmony relates only to pitch, but pitch does not really apply to percussion music, to noise, and certainly does not apply to silence, which I had come to regard as an essential complement of sound. Now, when you analyze the physical nature of sound, you find that it has three characteristics besides pitch: timbre, loudness, and duration. The only one of these four characteristics that does relate to both sound and silence is, quite obviously, duration. And so I came to realize that any structure for percussion music, for a situation in which harmony does not exist, must be based on duration or time. The structure of first construction in metal, then, is based on durations, or, as we have said, more specifically, on the proportions of durations. The proportions used are arranged symmetrically. They are 4, 3, 2, 3, 4, with a 16-measure bass. Thus, the first four 16-measure units are, according to the Peters Edition catalog, an exposition of individual bodies of material characterized by differences of rhythmic pattern and instrumentation. The remainder is development: 3 16-measure units, then 2, then 3, and finally again 4. Cage's interest in percussion ensembles hit a snag when he found there wasn't room in the dance theater for all the instruments he needed for a dance whose music he had been asked to write. The solution, arrived at after an abortive attempt to set the dance to a piano text, was to alter the piano sounds by inserting materials into the harp of the piano, which would stop the strings from vibrating at carefully planned distances, thus altering the tone of the instrument. "I soon had a whole new gamut of sounds, which was just what I needed," Cage is quoted as saying in the New Yorker profile. The piano had become, in effect, a percussion orchestra, under the control of a single player. Calvin Tompkins goes on to point out that the prepared piano, in its subsequent refinements, became the most widely known of all Cage's innovations. The earliest composition for prepared piano, which is available on a commercially released recording, is Amores, for prepared piano and percussion. The piano is used in the first and last movements. Here is an out-of-print recording of those movements, played by Maro Ajamian. Thank you. Amoris, as we have said, was written in 1943, a year after the Cages moved to New York. It was premiered in February at a concert of his music given at the Museum of Modern Art, the first of a series of one-man concerts which brought his music to the attention of the musical community. No doubt the composer was absorbed in himself at this time. The war was on, he was establishing his career, and he was being introduced, through Peggy Guggenheim and Max Ernst, to a variety of celebrities in the fields of other arts, as well as his own. In a foreword to the Peter Edition catalog, Cage refers to the work which occupied him between 1938 and 1951 as intentionally expressive composition. There were, of course, even in those days, adverse critical reactions to his music, and to the extent that his concerts drew larger and perhaps more significant audiences than he had experienced in Seattle, hostile remarks probably aroused a greater uncertainty, as Calvin Tompkins puts it, about his ability to express anything musically. Furthermore, his marriage was dissolving, and Cage went into a kind of retreat, devoting 18 months to the composition of the sonatas and interludes for prepared piano, a suite of 16 sonatas and 4 interludes, which the composer describes as an attempt to express in music the permanent emotions of Indian tradition, the heroic, the erotic, the wondrous, the mirthful, sorrow, fear, anger, the odious, and their common tendency toward tranquility. Working on the sonatas and interludes brought Cage to a study of Eastern and Western philosophy and to a discovery of D.T. Suzuki, the writer on Zen Buddhism. At about this time, then, Cage started developing the idea that it might be the function of music to help people attain a more intense awareness of their own lives rather than to express a conceit of the composer. In an essay written in 1949, The Forerunners of Modern Music, we find the first sentence, "Music is edifying, for from time to time it sets the soul in operation." Ananda K. Kumaraswamy had said that art should imitate nature in her manner of operation, and from this point on it had been Cage's attempt to render people more aware of the sounds they hear wherever they may be. The final effect of this change in attitude was not to be felt until 1951. In the meantime, Cage produced several works of a rather more lyrical nature than the music which had preceded the crisis of 1945 to 1948. Among these are the Nocturne for Violin and Piano, 6 Melodies for Violin and Keyboard, and, perhaps most notably, the String Quartet in 4 Parts, written in Paris in Anna Guggenheim Grant. Many of these works were based upon ideas which came to Cage as a result of the studies he had been pursuing in Oriental reading. The Seasons, a ballet commissioned by the Ballet Society of New York, was based on the traditional Indian view of the seasons as quiescence, winter, creation, spring, preservation, summer, and destruction, fall. The quartet of 1950 is built on much the same scheme, except that the order of the movements is summer, fall, winter, spring, producing perhaps a more optimistic effect on the listeners. Here is the second movement, Autumn in New York, of the string quartet.
Thank you.
You have heard the second movement, Autumn, of the string quartet by John Cage, written in 1950, perhaps the last of the expressive compositions which preceded the big break in his career of 1951. We have mentioned the change in Cage's attitude brought about by the unsettling events following the war. The dividing line in his career, as Calvin Tompkins points out in his New Yorker profile, was the move into chance operations which culminated the gradual shift in his thinking between, say, 1948 and 1951. It was about this time that Cage met Morton Feldman, a younger composer who introduced him to the pianist David Tudor. It was also at about this time that he met Christian Wolff, then a student still in high school, whose father, Kurt Wolff, was the founder of Pantheon Books. This firm had shortly afterward published the I Ching, an ancient Chinese book dealing with prediction through a sort of series of random tables. The monumental Music of Changes, in four volumes for solo piano, was perhaps the immediate result of Cage's discovery of the I Ching. The idea of rhythmic, or rather durational, structure is still present in Cage's music, but a complete break with his work before this period, 1951, is effected by the admission of chance techniques. In the Music of Changes, these techniques took the form of the tossing of coins to determine pitches, loudnesses, tempi, and so forth. Imaginary Landscapes No. 4 is written in the same way, but set for 12 radios instead of piano. Although not by any means the first time Cage has used such an instrument, Imaginary Landscape No. 1, written in 1939, had been scored for, among other things, two phonographs of variable speeds. Nevertheless, Imaginary Landscape No. 4, from 1951, seems to be the first of Cage's compositions to fall definitely this side of the big split in his career of 1951. Although there is no commercial recording of this work, we are fortunate enough to possess a copy of a private recording made of the premiere performance and its dress rehearsal. It is with this work that the average listener will encounter the John Cage that all the shouting is about. For with the Imaginary Landscape No. 4, we come to those compositions in which the aesthetic, or the procedure, behind the music, are of highest significance. About the only area shared with Cage's earlier aesthetic is the structure, which is still durational. But any trace of expressionism and of personality has been refined away. This is the beginning of Cage's notorious use of chance techniques, and furthermore, although he did not begin to work with indeterminate composition for almost another decade, at least with any consistency, there is a foreshadowing of this element in the Imaginary Landscape No. 4 as well. While the performers are told exactly what to do with the 12 radios used in the performance, Cage had no way of knowing what the radios themselves might be doing. In fact, the performance you will hear, a recording, as we have mentioned, of the premiere, illustrates the indeterminate aspects of the Imaginary Landscape quite graphically. The work was scheduled to close quite a long concert, and by the time it began, it was past midnight, and most radio stations had gone off the air. Therefore, more sound is generated by the audience, especially when they applaud a Mozart piece one station happens to be broadcasting, than is generated by the 12 radios used in the performance. Consequently, there is rather a thin texture to the piece, to the extent that Virgil Thompson, the critic on the New York Herald, who had until then been an ardent supporter of Cage's music, advised the composer that the piece shouldn't be performed on a concert at which an admission was charged. Relations between the two men have continued to be cool ever since, according to Calvin Tompkins. Here is the premiere performance of Imaginary Landscape No. 4 for 12 radios, recorded at Columbia University, May 2nd, 1951.
Thank you. and Burton Gander.
The imaginary landscape number 4, which you have just heard, might serve to conclude any survey of Cage's music. For to anyone whose qualifications fall short of those of a student of his music, the differences between this work, produced in 1951, and the works of the subsequent decade are differences in detail only. Tracing the history of Cage's gradual development to this point is easy enough, thanks to the New Yorker Profile, the Peters Edition catalog, and Cage's book, Silence. It is rather more difficult to define a consistent critical attitude toward Cage's output, toward his music and his aesthetics. There can be no question that the severe break we have noted in his development, the break between his string quartet of 1950 and the imaginary landscape number 4 of 1951, separates two careers, that of an interesting and inventive composer, the discoverer of the prepared piano, and the pioneer in the conscious use of durations as a structural device to supplant the harmonic formalism whose efficacy was questionable in the years after the dissolution of tonality on the one hand, and on the other, a near revolutionary whose thinking and whose music opens for the tradition of Western music a whole new field, and, correspondingly, a whole new responsibility. But before coming to an assessment of his current position, it might be well to look into Cage's description of himself as an experimenter. Clarifying her attitude to experimentalism in art, Gertrude Stein once said that an experimenter doesn't know where his investigations will take him, and that an artist was a person who had to know in advance the goal before him, and, by implication, the methods which were to take him to that goal. Cage feels that this doesn't really represent Gertrude Stein's methods, or Gertrude Stein herself, and that it is perhaps only a manifesto made for deceptive purposes, or perhaps an honest but erroneous attitude on her part. For himself, he seems to be devoting himself, and has said as much, to experimentation. Here, for example, is a quote from an interview published in the Peters Edition catalog. "I frequently say that I don't have any purposes and that I'm dealing with sounds, but that's obviously not the case. On the other hand, it is. That is to say, that I believe that by eliminating purpose, what I call awareness increases. Therefore, my purpose is to remove purpose. It's very simple to show. If I have a particular purpose, and then a series of actions comes about, and all I get is an approximation of my purpose, then nothing but a sort of compromise or disappointment can take place. And perhaps that still takes place when my purpose is to remove purpose. Namely, I see that I haven't really done it. But at least I'm going along in that general direction." When asked what an experimental act is, Cage replied, "Experimental music can have many definitions, but I use the word experimental to mean making an action the outcome of which is not foreseen." K. Cage is also, without question, devoting himself to the inculcation within the Western musical tradition of what has been until now strictly an Oriental attitude, the attitude of absorption with the object rather than the procedure. There is some slight precedent for this attitude in earlier Western music, passages in the later Mahler symphonies, and passages in certain scores by Charles Ives seem to prefigure the unique detachment which results from this shift in emphasis away from the interest in procedure, which marks the Western tradition from the Renaissance up to the early years of this century. But it is John Cage who has opened the doors wide to the incorporation of this attitude in our music, and it is perhaps due more to this than to anything else that the critics and the lay audiences have reacted, whether with favor or not, with generally little understanding. This lack of understanding reaches its apex in the frequent denunciations of Cage as a fraud, a word which implies a conscientious hoaxing of the public. This has its precedents too, of course. It's easy to recall the cries of anguish which attended the opening of the Armory Exposition 50 years ago, when Marcel Duchamp's Nude Descending a Staircase was first shown. Duchamp's history is perhaps enlightening in this context. After a short but immeasurably fertile period, culminating perhaps in the celebrated painting on glass called The Bride Stripped Bare by Her Bachelors Even, Duchamp broke off his creative career, except for occasional productions, and retired from the public eye. The one testimony which might be put forward in support of the charge that Cage deliberately hoaxes the public is, ironically, the box office success of many of his appearances in concerts of his own music. He is able to support himself through these appearances, and the last few years have seen frequent tours taking him around the world. But, characteristically, Cage's attitude toward this public interest seems detached. He's grateful for the opportunity it affords him to make a living, but it would be hard, after seeing him in these situations, and immediately after them, to accuse him of enjoying any lionization, certainly not to the extent of a Wagner or of a Liszt. And any charge of his work as being a colossal hoax has to resist the evidence of the discipline with which he perseveres in the course he has chosen. For he successfully avoids the temptation, which must, to judge by his pre-1950 compositions, be enticing, to develop his compositional ideas in the traditional manner. Furthermore, we have seen Cage reflecting on problems developing out of his work after the war, and suspending his composition for a period of reassessment. And it's likely that he would react in the same way to current adverse criticism if he didn't feel himself on the right track. Our survey of Cage's activities since 1951 has been inordinately sketchy. This will in part be rectified by a pair of programs to be heard later, a lecture by Leonard Meyer of the Music Department of the University of Chicago, and an answer to his lecture by Peter Winkler of the KPFA music staff. One's attention might also be drawn to the serial reading of Zen and the Art of Archery, which is tangent to any consideration of Cage's recent activities, and, of course, to the recordings of Cage's music, which should really be listened to in a spirit of open-minded, passive absorption. Let the reaction be separate from the hearing. Thank you for listening. This has been Charles Scheer with a program on the background of John Cage.